The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate
to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Soft sand beaches, clam shacks, and weather-worn shingled houses. Cape Cod is a slice of paradise for tourists and vacationers, and it is flooded with cheap heroin. Across the country, opioid-related deaths have quadrupled since 2001. New England has been especially hard hit. On the Cape alone, 85% of crime is opioid-related.
People come here to vacation, think it's a wonderful place. It's the worst place to be at right now. Everybody's dying left to right.
Down on the Cape, there's really, like, nothing to do, like, at all. Like, you either work and you're normal or you do drugs.
A new documentary from Oscar-winning filmmaker Stephen Okazaki shows us another Cape. The Dunkin' Donuts parking lots, the public restrooms, and smoke-filled apartments where opiate addicts score, use, rationalize, and talk with him candidly about their inability to overcome addiction. Heroin, Cape Cod, USA, is a documentary now available on HBO Go. Director Stephen Okazaki, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You follow 8 young people with a heroin habit. Many of them were first hooked on legal painkillers. Marissa, one of the characters, given Vicodin after she got her wisdom teeth pulled. Another in a motorcycle accident, given painkillers. Jessica, her face slashed up in an accident by a drunk driver. Here is, I think it's Ariana, remembering her first time.
I sniffed it and, like, the response happened in my brain. It was like I found, like, the love of my life, the other missing piece. Like, everything finally made sense.
The love of her life. Is that something that you heard commonly from the people that you followed?
Yeah. And she, you know, she went on to say it was, you know, the feeling was better than love. It was better than sex. It was better than children. And she had 2 children. And she, at the time of the film, when we were filming her, she had 3 years clean. And she was staying clean for her kids. And then that the drug, it's very hard for people to understand how powerful the drug is and how powerful the pull to it is. I think, you know, we all, you know, everybody has some kind of addiction. I don't know whether it's chocolate chip ice cream or, you know, watching a TV show or something. But, you know, it's hard to fathom. I mean, and I think, you know, it's easy to blame the users as well. But I think, you know, you can take someone with the exact same profile, you know, as one of these kids, and they, you know, they would not have a heroin problem. Mm. It's, you know, as they say in the film several times, it's a disease. It's something that just kids are vulnerable to it, and particularly at that age. I mean, I think taking up heroin at 14 or 16 is not the same kind of process as deciding to, you know, try it at the age of 30. I mean, you're so vulnerable. You're not getting along with your parents, and you don't know what you want to do with your life. You're feeling sort of isolated. You want to, you know, and something comes along that's going to block out that pain. But at the same time, yeah, at least half of the kids in the film were at least introduced by, you know, essentially by their doctors giving them prescriptions. And, you know, two of them were in serious car accidents, so they went home with a couple hundreds of pills, and you use those pills, you know, for 6 months, 7 months, and it can easily become a problem.
Well, she, Ariana, like others, she'd been through several treatment programs, she'd been to sober houses and rehabs, and survived nearly ODing more than once with the help of the drug Narcan. Let's hear a little bit more about Narcan.
The doctors told me to stop a couple times. Like, after the first couple times I've overdosed, I just kept dying.
Because I always thought, like, they're going to bring me back. They'll bring me back. They'll hit me with Narcan. I'm fine. They'll bring me back.
Well, the Narcan is kind of a Band-Aid for the people that overdose in the short term. But again, it's just a Band-Aid. That is just treating a symptom. These people are back on the street 45 minutes later doing the exact same thing. So you haven't actually fixed the problem whatsoever.
All the times I OD'd, I'd get right out of the hospital and I'd get high right after. I'd get high in the hospital parking lot.
That's a clip from Heroin, Cape Cod, USA. It's a new HBO documentary made by my guest, Stephen Okazaki. He's an Oscar-winning documentary film director. We heard a little bit from Marissa, one of the characters, along with Dr. Craig Cornwall there. You know, as many states and municipalities are putting Narcan in the hands of first responders and parents. We just heard from the doctor there, just a Band-Aid. Do you think addicts believe that they are bulletproof?
Well, I think that obviously Narcan has saved, you know, thousands. I have, you know, no idea how many lives. But it has, at the same time, emboldened kids to thinking they're, that someone will just, you know, Narcan them. You know, but you can get so loaded, someone can Narcan you over and over, and it won't bring you back. When you have addicts, there's always sort of a workaround. How, you know, how can I make this work for me? You know, once you're addicted, there are no simple solutions. For me, just observing it, I mean, it's just, you know, you can see how helpless people feel and how helpless their families are to help them. But, you know, much of the problem now, I mean, I think it's been different in different times, although there have been numerous attempts to commercialize opiates since the beginning of opiates. At the turn of the 19th century, Bayer, at the same time they were introducing aspirin and giving out free samples of aspirin, were also, Bayer gave heroin its name, and it was also offered free, as free samples, even to children, particularly to children and women, when it was introduced. So it's finally succeeded. Opiates have been commercialized, and they're so available. And it seems to me that's the place to attack the problem, is that supply.
Let's hear a little bit about the impact on families, which comes across very strongly in this film. One of the young women you talked to, Danielle, says, "Anyone with my last name, I've hurt the most." There's a support group made up of parents, mostly mothers, I notice. And here are a few clips from meetings. And let me just remark that they were not played together in the film.
If my kid had some other disease that was as dangerous to him as his addiction, people would be bringing casseroles, you know? But I haven't gotten any casserole.
I knew I played a part in it. You know, I was giving him money. I was enabling him to not have to go to work or, you know, whatever, like, you know, by buying the things, paying for his cell phone, doing all those things, I was giving him the money to go out and use his money for drugs.
Just so many different things in there. The kids say that themselves, I was happy. I wasn't a depressed kid or I wasn't molested. I was active in sports. You know, so in other words, none of these old notions of why people want to obliterate themselves. And it's not about socioeconomic status or education. Is opioid addiction a whole new ballgame than, you know, what you witnessed back in San Francisco during the heroin days? Is it just a new thing altogether?
Well, I think it is very different. When I was doing Black Tar Heroin in San Francisco in 1996, 1997, the kids that I came across had these backgrounds that were, you know, nightmarish. That, you know, the sexual and physical abuse and level of neglect, you thought, well, heroin's an option for them, you know, the one thing that might, you know, sort of block that out of their heads for a while. Now, you know, which is not to say that, you know, the kids in Cape Cod, USA, you know, don't have issues, but it's like, you know, what typical 18-year-old doesn't have a lot of drama going on in their head that they want to, you know, get rid of or solve or something. I think it is really different. There's a different kind of just, you know, seeking that good high sort of culture that, you know, that the culture has somehow enabled, where kids are, using alcohol or marijuana, and from lots of kids, you know, they stop there, and for others, they want a better high, and they start talking, and someone says, have you tried this, or have you tried that, and, you know, it, I think in past times, heroin's had this very different sort of aura, this sort of, you know, as the, you know, scariest, most deadly, most addictive of the drugs, and obviously because, you know, your first attempt at it doesn't have to be going down to the corner, and you can just go over to the medicine cabinet, you know, and get, you know, somebody's old prescription that they haven't thrown out, the leftovers from somebody's, you know, broken bones, or even a toothache, you know, you can get opiates. So the access to it is very different.
All of the addicts that we meet in your film are clearly struggling. But there's this one, Marissa, to me, just so heartbreaking. Obviously very smart, a little cocky. She makes clear that she never steals. You know, she dances at a strip club. She works as a prostitute to support her habit. But none of that saves her from shame.
I'm ashamed, and I think everybody sees my arms. I feel like everyone sees them everywhere I go. They're always looking, or like, I think people at Dunkin' Donuts even look. I feel like everyone's looking at me. Everybody knows. You know, I'm a good girl. Like, I don't know why I do this to myself. You just become so lost. And I just don't want to feel that pain. So that's why I get high. And I know people, you know, that's just an excuse, but f you, I don't want to feel it.
And that's Marissa. She is one of the addicts that is profiled in the film Heroin, Cape Cod, USA. It's a new HBO documentary directed by my guest, Stephen Okazaki, who's an Oscar-winning documentary director. That's one of the things that just really strikes me over and over again in this film, the kind of self-perception, the kind of honesty about who they are. Like, they're addicts. This is what they do. This is what they love. I'm just wondering how it struck you as a filmmaker.
Well, I think you feel the tragedy when you have someone like Marissa, who is so smart, you know, so articulate, funny, you know, passionate about life, and you think she's one of these people. If you met her, didn't know she was an addict, you'd think she could do anything. I should hire her to run my company, or you really feel the possibilities for her are sort of endless, but she's gone this other way. And she's 23 years old, and she's sort of the veteran user of the group. And we decided to use her as sort of the muse who comes in and out. She's not really part of the other people's stories, although she's well known. When we did her interview, she was not in Cape Cod. She had been part of that scene, but was working in a strip club in New Hampshire. But so we sort of had her as our sage coming in, sort of commenting on the lives of these newer users. And it was really, going through her transcripts, she could articulate any aspect of what addiction was, what it felt like, what someone goes through. You know, she was so smart, except unfortunately for herself, she was really vulnerable. And when we were doing the film, she was on Suboxone, and she was trying to not get high. She was using the chewing gum form of it, and but she had a boyfriend who was in jail, and when he got out, and then a few days later, Marissa overdosed and was gone. That was just a couple months ago.
You came to know these people, and not all turns out well for them, certainly. Now you're talking to the public about the film. You know, you're working with Governor Charlie Baker of Massachusetts. So what is it that you want to be saying to public policymakers, or the public, or healthcare workers after making this film?
Well, I think my goal as a filmmaker is, not political, not policy, really. I mean, my goal is to just put a human face on it. So when we talk about it, we don't just talk about numbers. We don't sort of stereotype who the addicts are, that we can put a human face on it. To me, the most powerful line in the film is when Marissa, who was on before, says, you know, don't disrespect me. I could be your daughter. And mm-hmm. I think that really is the theme of the film. I mean, it could be you. It could be someone really close to you. And so let's not just, you know, walk by it. The governor of Massachusetts the film is very graphic. It's, you know, uncensored. It's HBO, of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he had no qualms putting his full support. And we just showed the film to the White House drug czar, and there the White House is going to sponsor a screening in a couple weeks. So I don't know. That part is sort of unexpected. But I think, you know, our job is pretty much done. And I think the solutions are very difficult, but, you know, it's so bad, you know, people cannot avoid it anymore and have to pay attention to it. And if we can help illuminate it a little, that's great.
Well, it's a heartbreaking story, and I want to thank you very much for joining us to talk about it and for bringing it to us.
Thanks for having me.
Stephen Okazaki, he's the director of Heroin, Cape Cod, USA. It's a documentary that is now available on HBO Go. There's more on the film at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth!
Not all habits are destructive, but many of them equally hard to break. Producer Kelly Prime spoke with neuroscientist Kyle Smith about his research into how the brain controls habits.
Habits are stubborn. Ask any smoker. They lurk in your brain, quiet and unnoticed, until something triggers a craving. Galen Koch struggles with smoking, and she says triggers are everywhere.
Drinking, smoke and smoke is a cue.
Emotional cues,
stress,
like social stress.
Being at a party, feeling like you want to leave.
Seeing people smoke in movies is huge, especially if they look
good. If they're nasty people, it doesn't do it as much, but like watching old French films, like I'm done for. I have to go smoke a cigarette.
A craving hits and you can't help yourself. Zero control. You're having that cigarette. And that's because habits are permanent. Once you pick one up, it's wired in your brain forever. But the brain is complex, and cravings don't always get the final say. Kyle Smith and his team of researchers at Dartmouth College are trying to figure out how the brain controls habits, and how habits are controlling you. Right now, I'm in Kyle's basement laboratory. A few days ago, he put electrodes deep in a rat's head to turn brain activity into sound.
So what you're hearing is there's a hum just coming from the static. Behind that little hum, the white noise, there's these little like clicky sort of sounds, and that's every time you hear that is the neuron firing, responding, and it comes in little bursts.
To the untrained ear, that sound is static, but these scientists can hear from the clicks whether a cell is on or off. They're listening to the chatter of cells deep in the brain where habits are stored, and trying to figure out how to stop that chatter, how to break a habit. First, the scientists train rats in a maze made of clear plexiglass with an open top. It's shaped like a plus sign, so when the rat gets to the middle, it has to decide which way it wants to go.
They'll stop there, they'll pause, and they actually look down each arm as though thinking about that as an option, and then they'll make a choice. And as they get habitual, that goes away. They just, boom, they just turn, they know what they want to do, as though the decision was made already from the beginning.
Now the rat turns right, every time. And the scientists try to break that habit using a technology called optogenetics. Basically, they're shooting a laser into light-sensitive cells in the rat's brain. The laser turns cells on. So the rat's running along pretty much on autopilot. Just when it starts turning right, the scientists shine a yellow laser through fiber optic wires into the brain and something happens.
What we see is the return of this sort of behavior where, again, they're thinking, if I can say that word about rats, thinking about what they're doing and what the consequences might be.
Yes, it sounds like science fiction. Yes, it's real. To understand how lasers can take a rat off autopilot, we need to know a little bit more about how the brain works. Habits are stored in cells deep in the brain. But in order for a person or a rat to actually act on that habit, the cells need permission from another brain area called the cortex.
The upper layer, probably the most evolved part in the human.
And the cortex needs a cue.
Something like the movie Breathless. The lead character and the woman like just had sex and then they're like laying in bed together and they both light a cigarette. And in my head I'm just thinking, oh, that would be nice.
Your cortex notices that trigger and you crave a cigarette. Then the cortex sends a signal to start the habit and another to end it. You pick up the cigarette, smoke it, and put it down. But if the cortex signals too soon, you don't act on your craving. You break the habit. And that's exactly what Kyle is doing with his laser. The light jumpstarts cells in the cortex and makes them fire too soon, interrupting the habit. The tricky thing about this research is that it can't target just one habit and leave the others alone.
People are capable of multiple habits at once. You'd really want to avoid screwing up your other habits.
The good habits are all mixed up with the bad ones. And that makes this technology too dangerous to consider using in humans. Still, what Kyle and his team are doing is a big deal. They're targeting habits in the brain and bringing choice back into the equation. And since rat brains and human brains are structured almost identically, this research is a huge step forward toward understanding human habits and hopefully developing interventions to control them. No lasers necessary.
And that story was produced by Kelly Prime for the Salt Institute for Documentary Studies.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, as the old adage goes, never talk about money, religion, or politics in polite company. Well, in this 24-hour news cycle, good luck with that one. We're all hard-pressed to avoid complaining about politicians or the state of the world. And now that winter has decided to arrive, we'll probably revert to talking about the weather. Well, don't fret and don't stammer. Help is here. Chris Collin and Rob Baedeker are co-authors of What to Talk About. And we spoke to them last year when their book was first released. Chris and Rob, thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I was wondering which one of you was going to talk first.
That's a big problem, isn't it, in conversation, especially when you have more than two people.
On the radio.
That, yeah, awkward stall. So you've got to come prepared to put a foot forward and to offer something.
Well, we believe in breaking the don't talk about money rule. We believe in breaking almost every rule because saying the right thing is too much pressure. Saying the wrong thing is often far more interesting, and that's the point of conversation. We're trying to be interesting and memorable. Life is short. You got to talk a little more boldly.
Almost every rule? Are there any things that are just taboo you won't even touch?
We're just going to wait and see if you do that, and then we'll let you know if you said something horribly offensive.
Well, let's make it clear. You are not scientists. You're not motivational speakers, but you're academics. So who's your audience for this book?
Our audience, well, at first it was ourselves, and then it sort of became everyone when we realized that a lot of people shared our problem. We found that we were sort of panicking all the time, really. I mean, we're relatively smart people, especially me. And yet, you know, you find yourself in an elevator or on the seat next to someone on a plane, and you sort of panic over what to say. Or you have a really close friendship or a romantic relationship. You've been together or been friends for many years, and your conversations are sort of middling.
Everywhere we go, people, when they hear about the book, say, I need that. And they're good talkers. I mean, we're doing fine, but there's about a 10% gap or 11% because we are actually scientists and inventors and motivational speakers and now authors. And people want to get better. They want to bridge the gap about 10% of the time to go further, make it more interesting, make it more fun.
So you guys are really good at filling in those awkward pauses with some conversation starters or cold openings, as you call them. My favorite might have been, I bet your spirit animal is an attic raccoon. Sure to get a...
Virginia, that's your spirit animal, isn't it?
How did you know?
There's something, I think, in the voice. We're very intuitive. And
being intuitive is part of being a good talker. You've got to relax. Sometimes you have to close your eyes in a conversation, tune into your instincts.
And you're very resourceful, obviously. We just met you. But an attic raccoon has figured some stuff out, how to find a warm house. You know, this is a compliment.
Well, thank you very much, because I'm not sure if I feel complimented. But what are some of the other kind of cold openings that you guys have come up with?
Well, often often we need conversation in these sort of glancing exchanges with the person at the cash register in the checkout lane at the grocery store. You know, Rob, what would you say to that person when you don't just want to say, hi, how's it going?
I'd say those shoes are incredible. Where did you get them? I would say, you know, offer a dilemma to people. This gets the mind going in a different way. I would say if you had a third eye in the middle of your back and you were online dating, would you mention it in your profile or would you wait for the first date? It really lets people open up.
Yeah. Does anybody look at you when you say something like that to them and maybe think, I don't think I want to talk to this person?
If that happens, you're doing something right. No, but in all seriousness, you know, we think it's okay to sort of go into weird territory every now and then. You don't want to be totally weird and have no friends. But in our experience, people are open to all sorts of things, far more than we think when we walk into a conversation. People want to go into left field every now and then because, you know, deep inside, we're all weird.
People do say, though, that they dislike small talk. You know, it's superficial, it's party talk. But they seem to do plenty of it. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, small talk is a great starting place. We don't dismiss small talk, but you gotta make it bigger. You gotta push further. So the classic small talk subject is the weather, right?
Right.
And how's the weather? It's cold, it's hot. Pretty finite category. But push that into big talk by asking a weather-related question. For example, what's the coldest you've ever been? Or what's the worst sunburn you've ever had? You take the weather and you push it into the realm of story. And now we're getting somewhere.
I guess that's sort of like approaching a good interview. You know, you don't want to ask people a yes or no question. You want to make them tell a story.
Right. Yeah, curiosity is key, right? And also admitting your own ignorance. Too often we're worried about looking smart or letting on that we don't know something. But if you can put your heads together with somebody, ignorance is fun. In other words, you can explore the question of what is wind? What is thunder? Speaking of weather-related topics, I kind of know, but I'm not totally sure. And if I pair up with a good conversation partner, we can have fun exploring that.
What exactly was the Korean War about? Could I really describe the difference between a democracy and a republic? You know, if you sort of expose your ignorance, we find that that's a great way to connect with people because then they can expose theirs and then you can sort of bond over how stupid you are. And that's sort of a sweet feeling. It's poignant.
I'm speaking with Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker. They are co-authors of the book, What to Talk About. This is for on a plane or at a cocktail party or in a tiny elevator with your boss's boss. What kind of things do you say? You're talking a little bit also about how we reflect each other, right? There's a segment in the book on mirroring that our mm-hmm. responses to small questions actually matter. So tell us about this mirroring phenomenon.
Well, mirroring is repeating blandly the same words or idea of the person you're talking to. We do it all the time, right? So it's a beautiful day. Yeah, it's a beautiful day. And the conversation just drops a transmission, so to speak, and all of its tires go flat.
There's also a lot of mirroring that happens just in the most common conversation starter and killer, which is, hi, how's it going? And we mirror by even indulging that question, fine, it's going fine. And Rob and I are big advocates of answering the question that you wish had been asked. How's it going? You know, I've been thinking about the Chuckwalla lizard, which is a real lizard that can live without water. And pretty soon you're talking about what it means to live without water, how the scientists even learned this, and you can start talking about something more interesting than how's it going.
Okay, so you guys are talking about a lot of interpersonal stuff, but how about a party? Now, this is the sort of the nadir for people who are fearful of coming up with the right conversation. How do you prepare?
Well, one thing we recommend is preparing. You know, I think people are a little allergic to the idea of coming to a social situation with some kind of canned answer. You might seem like a phony or something.
But preparing, you mean like, you know, sort of in the bathroom mirror before you go, preparing some small talk?
Any mirror, bathroom, bedroom, car mirror.
They make tiny mirrors now you can actually carry around in your pocket.
But anyways, no, we mean, you know, having something ready to go in case your mind goes white and you absolutely can't summon a thought And then it's fine to say, hey, you know, this reminds me of something I've been thinking about.
You use the word nadir, Virginia, which is a great word. And if I had nothing else to talk about right now, I might ask you about that word, which is an example of what we call a trigger word, pulling something out of the other person's sentence and being curious about it or taking it in a new direction.
Well, I wondered if I should have said nadir, actually.
I wondered, too. You know, that's something to talk about. How confident were you when you said nadir? You know, I think we all sort of wonder about these kinds of things all the time. Did I say it wrong? Oh, my God.
Well, all right, I'm going to set the scene here. We're at a party, or you're at a party. You don't know that many people. Everybody seems to be insulated in impenetrable conversations. They're talking about nadirs or nadirs and fascinating things like that. So how do you break in?
Well, one thing that you can do is play a game. People like games. We're all children inside. Walk into a circle and say, okay, I'm just going to introduce myself. My name is so-and-so. Who would each of you be if you had to be cast in a movie? You know, who do we think we are? Are you the nabishy accountant? Are you the sarcastic, wisecracking friend? Are you the swashbuckling hero? And pretty soon you're not, you know, it's a safe topic. Everyone knows about movies. It's funny. But you're sort of introducing yourselves.
Facebook and Twitter are often dismissed as party conversation, as superficial conversation. Is the nature of conversation changing since we have Facebook and Twitter? Because, you know, there are a lot of provocative things that are put out in social media.
I think that they are great. They're wonderful. Anytime you're having a nice time and sharing pictures of your kids, that's great. But I also think it's good to be mindful of the ways that they are sucking the thoughts out of our heads, even when we're not aware. I mean, think about the last time you were waiting for your hot dog to finish microwaving. What did you do? You took the phone out of your pocket and you Instagrammed. It used to be that we would have thoughts pop into our head and the well of ideas would gradually replenish. And now I you know, we worry that that's not happening as much as it should.
On the other hand, you can hone your language, especially on Twitter, where brevity is a necessity. It allows you to sharpen your thoughts and you can recycle those in the real world.
Well, good to know. Thank you for that helpful tip and all the rest, Chris and Rob.
Thank you, Virginia.
Thanks, Virginia.
Chris Collin and Rob Bedeker. They are co-authors of What to Talk About on a Plane, at a Cocktail Party, in a Tiny Elevator with Your Boss's Boss, all sorts of different situations. And if you'd like to be further convinced, you can watch a brilliant little book trailer for them. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org.
Don't you hate that?
Hate what?
Uncomfortable silences. Why do we feel it's necessary to yak about in order to be comfortable?
I don't know. That's a good question.
We just learned a few novel tricks for starting conversations. Let's turn now to discussions conducted without making a sound, using sign language, where eye contact is key. This story comes to us from Roman Mars and 99% Invisible.
Do you mind if I talk to you while we walk?
If you've ever seen an episode of the TV show The West Wing, you probably know one of its trademark scenes, the walk and talk.
You're going to this meeting?
Yeah. WW160, you've been able to find it?
I don't even know where I am right now.
I'm looking on this side again.
Do you mind if I talk to you while we walk?
But after you watch a few episodes, you might notice something. The characters almost never look at each other. They mostly look straight ahead. And there's a good reason for this. When people walk and talk, they don't need to look at each other. We use our eyes to navigate. We use our ears to listen.
But that doesn't work if you're deaf.
That's our reporter today, Tom Dreisbach. He went to Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. to talk to a researcher named Robert Servage.
Gallaudet is the only university in the world designed entirely for the deaf and hard of hearing. Robert is deaf himself, and he's been looking into this question of how deaf people walk and sign.
Robert Servage put cameras on the heads of different pairs of people, both hearing and deaf.
And he did this so he could precisely monitor what people look at when they walk and talk versus when they walk and sign. And he found very clear differences.
This is the voice of a Gallaudet translator speaking for Robert.
To hearing people look straight ahead the whole time they were walking,
you might see just a few seconds, very rare seconds, when the person would look at the other person who they were walking beside and speaking. They wouldn't ever make eye contact. One would look at the other. While as with deaf people, there was that continuous maintained eye contact.
But maintaining eye contact also means you can't pay full attention to any obstacles up ahead.
And that's a problem if you're walking.
For walking and signing to work, the people holding a conversation need to keep an eye out for obstacles.
But it's not like deaf people make a deal at the beginning of a conversation. You talk, I'll be the lookout.
When deaf people are looking at one another, there's an agreement, an internal agreement, unspoken agreement that's understood between the two people conversing.
It's almost like the people, when you're in a conversation, you're in a kind of dance where you're not discussing what's happening between each other, but you just sort of know what the next move should be.
That's exactly it.
But when they're designing buildings, most hearing architects are not thinking about providing a venue for this dance.
That's actually also true of many buildings at Gallaudet University, even though it's dedicated to teaching the deaf and hard of hearing. But several years ago, the university realized that some of its standards of architecture and innovation had slipped.
So Gallaudet asked architect Hansel Baumann to help lead a group project called Deaf Space to collect ideas and rethink campus design with deaf people in mind.
The campus took those ideas and poured them into the design of a new building called the Sorensen Language and Communication Center, but everyone calls it the SLCC.
There are some obvious things like adding automatic sliding doors so conversations don't grind to a halt at every threshold.
And then there are more subtle changes. One of the big ideas behind Deaf Space is avoiding eye strain. That's because when you communicate all day with your eyes, it's easy to get tired.
So if you have bad lighting conditions, for example, which is backlighting, glare, high contrast between dark spaces and light spaces, all of those annoyances in and of themselves may not be so bad, but taken together over the time of a day, it's the beginning of eye strain. And eye strain really wears people out, basically.
And when we walked by a classroom, Hansel pointed inside at the color scheme.
The color of the blue classroom, that's a color we've been experimenting with, is a good contrast to a range of skin tones. You can just so clearly see sign language in there.
And for Hansel, working on Deaf Space has meant becoming sensitive to a range of issues that he had never thought of before.
The window that the deaf experience offers to architects is to provide us with a new kind of awareness around what's working and what's not working in a room that we might accept every day as just kind of our condition and we're not aware of it. It's not in front of us in a way that we can name what's the aggravation in the room or the environmental stressor. We don't have a way to recognize that, whereas I think it's part of everyday deaf experience.
That's Roman Mars, host and producer of the design and architecture podcast, 99% Invisible.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Without sight, the blind rely on the soundscapes around them to navigate the world. But that can be complicated for those living in cities, where hustle and bustle brings with it lots of noise. Seattle producer Noel Clark brings us this story.
Wait!
The world can be a noisy place. From talking traffic signs and passing cars to hallway conversations and high heels.
Computer.
For one reason,
at least that's what I'd say. It took a good sensory system.
For people like 20-year-old Jordan Strom, navigating this auditory ocean requires special skills.
I was born blind.
For sighted people, everyday sounds sometimes take a back seat to vision. But these are important to Jordan for a few reasons.
Well, there are two issues that come up.
This is Bert.
Hi, my name's Bert Schlau, and I'm a professor in speech-language hearing sciences.
First, we need to, well, I'll let Bert explain.
One of them is how a person who's blind is able to navigate and know what objects are in the environment without seeing them. What some do is produce clicks or they'll bang a cane. What that does is it causes the different frequencies to bounce off of objects.
When our ears receive these sounds, they receive them at two different times. For example, a sound from the right reaches the right ear first and the left ear second because of the diameter of the head.
We have cells within our brainstem that are able to assess these differences to within a millionth of a second.
A millionth of a second might not seem like much, but for Jordan, It's this brain function that allows him to determine his location in relation to other objects in space.
Buildings I can pick up from the echo. So if there's a building to the right and I hear an echo, I can usually estimate the distance based off of that.
But distance isn't the only spatial consideration the brain takes into account. Size is also a factor.
We also use information about the overall timbre of the sound. And we can judge how big or small a room is by the sounds of the echoes.
Timbre is the quality a sound has that distinguishes it from other sounds. But the ability to differentiate these sounds is inherent in most people.
Even if you were to blindfold someone who has vision within normal limits, they could tell whether they were in a big or a small room based on the echoes that come back.
At Vision Loss Resources on the corner of Franklin and Lindale in Uptown, I get the chance to put this to the test.
Yeah, just keep it like that.
Let's try it with the blindfold.
Okay.
VLR is a resource for people with low or no vision, as well as the sighted. Training sessions such as this are designed for individuals with declining vision to instruct them on how to remain mobile once their sight is gone.
Okay, I just make sure that you don't hit anything. The cane will
it's
hit it.
7 a.m. on a brisk Wednesday morning, and I'm about to step out onto one of the busiest streets in South Minneapolis, blindfolded.
All right, we'll go straight ahead, find the door.
Okay.
There you go, walk right up to it. Find it with your hand and then push. And then we'll do it for the second door as well.
Straight ahead as well?
Correct. Make a right turn.
The 10 minutes it takes me to walk around the block and back to the front door of VLR is only a fraction of what your average, relatively mobile blind person might experience in a day.
Handrail?
Okay.
Being deprived of sight and having to rely on only my ears to guide me, the cane in front of me, and the way the ground feels under my feet is a terrifying yet liberating experience. However, sound and the cane alone aren't for everyone.
It's right out there and it makes you look blind. I liked what a dog could give a person as far as mobility.
This is Sam Jasmine. To her side sits Jenny, her guide dog.
And people, you know, have interesting reactions to, you know, canes and disabilities and depending on how much knowledge they have about the situation.
So for a half an hour once a week, Sam creates her own world of audio sounds on KFAI, a local community radio station.
My show is Disabled and Proud, and it's all on disability topics.
Wading through this world of sound can be a difficult thing, but just knowing that people like Sam and Jordan are out there to help makes it a little less scary.
How do you relate to other people with low vision or no vision? Like if I had just lost my sight and I was very frustrated or upset, like what would you say?
I would tell them that you're not completely stuck, you're not helpless. There is accommodations you can get and you're gonna make it through the world, because I got this far. Millions of other people have that are blind and visually impaired. You're just gonna have to get used to learning things a new way and adapting to them.
For Culture Q, I'm Noel Clark.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us today, and we do invite you to share what you heard with others. You can go to wordofmouthradio.org for a deep list of segments to listen to, post on social media, or email to friends. And let us know what you're curious about, the stories and sources you find interesting, or what's scratching at your sense of wonder. We do find the best stories tend to bounce around by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Let's keep on sharing them. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.